Random House Audio presents The Paris Vendetta by Steve Barry. Read for you by Scott Brick. Money has no motherland. Financiers are without patriotism and without decency. Their sole object is gain. Napoleon Bonaparte. History records that the money changers have used every form of abuse, intrigue, deceit, and violent means possible to maintain their control over governments. James Madison. Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who writes the laws. Meyer Amschel Rothschild. Prologue. Giza Plateau, Egypt. August, 1799. General Napoleon Bonaparte dismounted from his horse and stared up at the pyramid. Two more lay in succession nearby, but this was the grandest of the three. What a mighty prize his conquest had yielded. The ride south yesterday from Cairo, through fields bordering muddy irrigation canals, and the quick trek across wind-blown sand had been uneventful. 200 armed men had accompanied him, as it was foolhardy to venture this far out into Egypt alone. He'd left his contingent a mile away, camped for the night. The day had been another arid scorcher, and he'd intentionally waited until sunset before visiting. He'd arrived ashore near Alexandria 15 months ago with 34,000 men, 1,000 guns, 700 horses, and 100,000 rounds of ammunition. He'd quickly advanced south and taken the capital, Cairo, his aim being to disorganize any resistance through rapidity and surprise. Then he'd fought the Mamelukes not far from here, in a glorious conflict he'd dubbed the Battle of the Pyramids. Those former Turkish slaves had ruled Egypt for 500 years, and what a sight! There had been thousands of warriors, dressed in colorful garb, mounted atop magnificent stallions. He could still smell the cordite, feel the roar of cannon, hear the snap of muskets, the screams of dying men. His troops, many veterans of the Italian campaign, had fought bravely, and while suffering only 200 French dead, he'd captured virtually the entire enemy army, gaining total control of Lower Egypt. One reporter had written that a handful of French subdued a quarter of the globe. Not exactly true, but it sounded wonderful. The Egyptians had dubbed him Sultan El Kabir, a title of respect, they'd said. During the past 14 months, ruling this nation as commander-in-chief, he'd discovered that as other men loved the sea, so he loved the desert. He also loved the Egyptian way of life, where possessions counted little and character much. They also trusted Providence, as did he. "Welcome, General. Such a glorious evening for a visit," Gaspard Monge called out in his usual cheerful tone. Napoleon enjoyed the pugnacious geometer, an older Frenchman, son of a peddler, blessed with a wide face, deep-set eyes, and a fleshy nose. Though a learned man, Monge always toted a rifle and a flask, and seemed to crave both revolution and battle. He was one of 160 scholars, scientists, and artists. Savants, the press had labeled them, who had made the journey from France with him, since he'd come not only to conquer, but to learn. His spiritual role model, Alexander the Great, had done the same when invading Persia. Monge had traveled with Napoleon before in Italy, ultimately supervising the looting of that country, so he trusted him. To a point. "You know, Gaspard, as a child I wanted to study science. During the revolution in Paris, I attended several lectures on chemistry. But alas, circumstances made me an army officer." One of the Egyptian workers led his horse away, but not before he grabbed a leather satchel. He and Monge now stood alone, luminous dust dancing in the shadow of the Great Pyramid. "A few days ago," he said, I performed a calculation and determined that these three pyramids contain enough stone to build a wall 1 meter wide and 3 meters high around the whole of Paris. Monge seemed to ponder his assertion. That could well be true, General. He smiled at the equivocation. Spoken like a doubting mathematician. Not at all. I just find it interesting how you view these edifices. Not in relation to the pharaohs, or the tombs they contain, or even the amazing engineering used to construct them. No, you view these only in terms related to France. That is hard for me not to do. I think of little else. Since his departure, France had fallen into impossible disarray. Its once great fleet had been destroyed by the British, isolating him here in Egypt. The ruling directory seemed intent on warring with every royalist nation, making enemies of Spain, Prussia, Austria, and Holland. Conflict to them seemed a way to prolong their power and replenish a dwindling national treasury. Ridiculous. The Republic was an utter failure. One of the few European newspapers that had made its way across the Mediterranean predicted it was only a matter of time before another Louis sat on the French throne. He had to return home. Everything he cherished seemed to be crumbling. "France needs you," Monge said. "Now you speak like a true revolutionary." His friend laughed. "Which you know I am." 7 years ago, Napoleon had watched as other revolutionaries stormed the Tuileries Palace and dethroned Louis XVI. He'd then faithfully served the new republic and fought at Toulon, afterward promoted to brigadier general, then to general of the Eastern Army, and finally commander in Italy. From there he'd marched north and taken Austria, returning to Paris a national hero. Now, barely 30, as general of the Army of the Orient, he'd conquered Egypt. But his destiny was to rule France. "What a superfluity of wonderful things," he said, admiring again the great pyramids. During the ride from his camp, he'd spied workers busy clearing sand from a half-buried sphinx. He'd personally ordered the excavation of the austere guardian and was pleased with the progress. "This pyramid is closest to Cairo, so we call it the first," Monge said. He pointed at another. "The second. The farthest is the third. If we could but read the hieroglyphs, we could perhaps know their true labels." He agreed. No one could understand the strange signs that appeared on nearly every one of the ancient monuments. He'd ordered them copied. So many drawings that his artists had expended all of the pencils brought from France. It had been Monge who devised an ingenious way to melt lead bullets into Nile reeds and fashion more. "There may be hope there," he said, and he caught Monge's knowing nod. They both knew that an ugly black stone found at Rosetta, inscribed with three different scripts, hieroglyphs, the language of ancient Egypt, Demotic, the language of current Egypt, and Greek, might prove the answer. Last month he'd attended a session of his Institut Egypt, created by him to encourage his savants, where the discovery had been announced. But much more study was needed. "We are making the first systematic surveys of these sites," Monge said. "All who came before us simply looted. We shall memorialize what we find." Another revolutionary idea, Napoleon thought, fitting for Monge. "Take me inside," he ordered. His friend led him up a ladder on the north face to a platform 20 meters high. He'd come this far once before, months ago, with some of his commanders, when they'd first inspected the pyramids. But he'd refused to enter the edifice since it would have required him to crawl on all fours before his subordinates. Now he bent down and wiggled into a corridor no more than 1 meter high and equally as wide, which descended at a mild gradient through the pyramid's core. The leather satchel swung from his neck. They came to another corridor hewn upward, which Monge entered. The gradient now climbed, heading to
Sample complete. Ready to continue?